good group, but Doreen, will you let us know when we have a quorum? I think we'll make it.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to just welcome everyone. It's a beautiful evening, and I really appreciate each and everyone who made time for this meeting this evening. We couldn't really proceed with the work that we want to do without everyone attending that is able, and so thank you so much for being here. I have the distinct pleasure of getting to introduce three four new members, so we're really growing our group getting close to the number that we want to be. I think we're almost there. So I'm looking to see if we have our newest members. Doreen, are you able to tell what I might not be able to? I can see.
Yes. So, and to confirm, we do have a quorum. Michelle Stickley is here with us, and Andy Santos, and then we're just waiting on Shona Carter. She would be our third.
Okay. Well, then maybe what we'll do is I'll go ahead and start by introducing the new members that are currently present, and I will take them one at a time. Andy, I will be starting with you. Andy Santos is joining our group as the youth representative, and it's a very important role. And Andy, would you please share a little bit about yourself? We know that you are, I believe you're on the phone. Oh, there you are. Now I can see you, Andy. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Would you share a little bit about yourself so we can get to know you?
Of course. So I will give it beforehand if my internet cuts out. I'm currently in Mexico. So I'm Andy Santos, and I'm a senior from Gila High School. And so far, the biggest thing that I'm involved in right now. Can you hear me?
Andy, you're breaking up a little bit.
Andy, we're not able to hear you now. So maybe what we'll do is...
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes. Yes. But your screen is frozen. Now we can't hear you. So I think we're going to...
Okay. So, I'm a senior from Gila High School.
Andy, we lost you again, so I think we're going to move on, and we'll try to circle back if we're able to. It looks like you're on mute right now, too. So let's go ahead, and Michelle Stickley, I'd like to introduce you next.
Hi, I'm Michelle Stickley, and I am a resident of Camas, but I do a lot of my nonprofit work in Vancouver. I currently sit on the board of directors for Hope Dementia Support. I also sit on the Ethics Review Committee for Public Health. What else do I do? I do many things. I work with LULAC to serve Latinos here in Vancouver. My passion and my education is for the aging population, and working with LULAC, I just secured $300,000 loan to do outreach to the Latino community for dementia support resources. That goes to Skamania, Clark, and Pallets County. So that was a big win, and we're really excited that we'll be able to do a lot of outreach for those communities, because those populations are mostly affected, and I'll be working doing some outreach to the NAACP as well, because the numbers for dementia and Alzheimer's are as high for the Black communities. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. That was a great intro. Thank you so much. And now Shona, this is Shona Carter. I'll be introducing you next. And I have missed you. I'm so happy to have the opportunity to work on a group again with you, and welcome to the Public Health Advisory Council. And if you could please share a little bit about yourself so that members can get to know you a little better.
So my name is Shona Carter. I am the VP of Community Engagement and Strategy at Community Foundation for Southwest Washington. And we make grants to three counties in Clark, Skamania, and Cowlitz County. I started there maybe about, I guess it was in 2015, and started out as their program officer, their first program officer, building out their grant making program that largely education and youth development, asset building, and basic needs, which include healthcare. And I have a 20-year career in philanthropy, coming from the San Francisco Foundation, and then previously before San Francisco, the East Bay Community Foundation in Oakland. And happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So the next thing that we'll be doing is doing a roll call. We do have some guests, and I will get to that next after we do the roll call. So Doreen's going to have some is here, but I'm going to call out your name, and if you could please say whether you are just present, if you're on the Zoom meeting and you're using your computer. But if you're on the phone, just please say that you're on the phone. We just want to make sure we count everybody. So I'll start with you, Chief Brooks.
Sorry, I had to unmute. Yes, I am present. Thank you.
Sandra Brown.
I'm present. Thank you.
Joan Cayley.
I'm here. Thank you.
Jonah Carter.
Present.
Paul Childers.
Present.
And Tyler Clary.
Present.
Mark Collier.
Present.
Okay. Heather Decker?
Present.
Remy Youson?
Present.
Adrian Fairbanks?
Present.
Thanks for joining
us. On the phone.
Great, thank you. Dave Fuller is not able to attend this evening. I've gotten a message about that. Charbonneau Gord? I believe Sharb is also not able to attend tonight. Aru Hedrick? Not present yet. Maybe still coming. Dr. Ellen Mellick? See you.
Can you hear me okay? I think I'm having internet problems. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my voice is coming through at least. Okay. You're all frozen at various times, which makes me think I'm having internet problems.
Dr. Lawrence Neville.
Yeah, good evening, everyone.
Thank you for being here. Rosie Yamashita? Rosie?
No, it's Royce, but yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you for correcting that. My mistake. Apologies. And I'm Marla Sanger. And Andy Santos?
I am present. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think I saw, I believe that Andrea put out a little message that we might have try to hold a little time for you so we can try again. Maybe things will work better later. And then Cassie Sellards Rick. I don't see Cassie. Michelle Stickley. And I know Michelle is here.
I said hi.
Okay, thank you. And Maria Swinger Inskeep.
How's that?
Thank you for joining us. Okay, so we have a quorum, so we can carry on to the next part. We do have some guests, and so if we could, at this time, before we get on to reviewing and approving the minutes, if there are guests who I haven't mentioned, would you please say your name, and if you're representing an organization, the organization that you are representing, and then in a few minutes we'll talk about if any of you wish to make comment. Oh, I see you, Dr. Gross. You're on mute, but I know that you are here, and and I'll circle back with you in a minute.
Okay.
And then we were also expecting Rachel Fisher. Is Rachel Fisher on the phone? Are there any other guests here that have not spoken up? Okay, then. Moving on. We'll be reviewing and approving the June 8th, 2021 meeting notes. The way we're going to do this, I'll entertain a motion, we'll have a second, and then we'll vote. If you are voting affirmatively, then we'll just say aye, or if you're opposed, say no, but also please say your name so there more than one person says no, we can have a count. So I'm going to ask for a motion to approve the minutes.
I move to approve the minutes.
Great, thank you.
I'll second.
Okay, thank you. All right, then we have a motion and a second to approve the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Anyone opposed, please say no and your name. Hearing none, the minutes will be officially approved. Thank you. I'm going to go through the agenda really briefly, and then I'll be asking if there are any public comments. So on the agenda tonight, after we see if there are any public comments, we're going to have the department update. There will be a COVID update as part of that. And you have, if you have your agenda, you'll see what the topics will be under the department update. It's, some of these are things that we hear now and then, and some of these things will be possibly new for you to hear tonight. The executive committee is going to bring forward some information about the potential of having a bylaw subcommittee, and I'll be talking about that a little later on in the evening. And then we're going to have an opportunity to recognize a couple of our Public Health Advisory Council members that are in transition right now, Charbonneau Gord and Joan Cayley. And then we'll have a little time for Q&A or any other information or updates that our members would like to provide. So that's everyone's opportunity to speak up. And then we'll be closing our meeting. So the next thing that we'll be doing is asking if any of our guests, and right now I only know of Dr. Gross. Dr. Gross, I want to thank you for sending the question that you had for us in advance. And so would you like to share the question and any thoughts that you have about that?
Sure.
Great, thank
you. I'm Amy Gross, and I'm a commissioner on the Clark County Commission on Aging. And we are very interested in knowing any data or information you have regarding older adults and how the Delta variant or whatever variant it is, how COVID is impacting the over 65 community. Our plan for this year in our monthly meetings is to study different aspects of aging in Clark County that where we can recommend suggestions for ongoing or for the next pandemic or whatever we've learned from the last year. Right now we're studying medical issues. We've had somebody speak about food as medicine and other people talking about different aspects of how the medical field interacts with older adults. And I'm here to listen.
Thank you. So Dr. Melnick, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay? I'm getting messages that my internet is unstable, so, and you're all frozen at various times here, so, but you can hear me okay?
Yes. And were you able to hear the question that Dr. Gross put forth?
Yes, and I'm going to address that, and I'm going to be talking about COVID-19, so I hope to address that in my, I'll make sure I address that question when I talk about, I give the COVID-19 update.
Okay.
That's okay.
Yes. That's very good. Dr. Gross, will you be able to stay with us?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. That sounds like a great plan. All right, then anyone else that's a visitor wishing to make public comment? Speak now. Okay. Hearing no one, we'll move on to the department updates. And first we're going to have a presentation from the Environmental Public Health members of that team about the 2021 swim beach monitoring using Environmental Public Health satellite data. And we have Alyssa Payne and Kelly Fry presenting for us this evening.
Awesome, thank you.
I'm gonna just share my screen real quick. Okay, can everyone see the slides?
Yes.
Yeah, you're good.
All right, well, hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me tonight. My name is Kelly Fry, and this summer I've been able to do an internship with the Swim Beach Monitoring Program at Clark County Public Health. And so I'm just going to give a little bit of detail about some of the really cool work I've been doing with using satellite imaging for early detection of harmful algal blooms in Clark County. Before that, though, I'll hand it off to my mentor, Alyssa Payne, so she can just give a quick overview of what the Swim Beach program does on a day-to-day basis.
Hi, so I'm Alyssa Payne. I'm an environmental health specialist with Clark County Public Health. I work in our Swim Beach monitoring program during the summers, supporting and mentoring our lovely internship students through their projects. So what we do in the Swim Beach program is we provide timely, accessible information on water quality for mostly our designated swim beaches, those being Klein Line Pond, Vancouver Lake, and Battleground Lake. But we also do respond to, for example, other unsafe conditions such as a harmful algal bloom and any water body that has a public access point. And so during those periods of unsafe conditions, we work with lake managers and parks departments to post advisories and notifications warning recreators of the potential risk and providing water contact recommendations. And we also issue weekly newsletters that you could actually sign up for on our website. And we provide those every Friday during the summer that provide you all the most up-to-date advisory information. And then we also have information for you and your family on how to recreate safely and also information on how you can improve water quality here in Clark County. And I'll hand it back to Kelly for him to talk about his project more.
All right, thank you, Alyssa. So moving on, what exactly are harmful algal blooms? They are characterized by the rapid growth of algae or cyanobacteria, which can cause harm to people, animals, and the local ecosystem. In Clark County specifically, most of the blooms we're concerned about are cyanobacteria, which aren't actually algae. They're a kind of bacteria, just like the name suggests. But we usually just use the umbrella term harmful algal bloom to make things easier to communicate and talk about. In Clark County, the two most common toxins that we see from cyanobacteria blooms are microcystin and anatoxin, which are a liver toxin and a neurotoxin, respectively. Now, algae and cyanobacteria are pretty much always present to some degree in local ecosystems, but when conditions are favorable enough for them, they can grow out of control, which not only poses issues for human health, but the health of ecosystems as well. There are generally three key factors that often lead to a bloom forming. The first is stagnant water, which is inherently warmer than flowing water. Sunlight is also important because these organisms are photosynthetic, which means if they have more sunlight, they have more energy to grow and multiply. And then third is nutrient pollution, especially when it comes to nitrogen and phosphorus. These are normally limiting nutrients for these organisms, so when they have a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus, they can grow very rapidly. The issue that we are faced with as a public health department is that it's really difficult to predict when and where a bloom is going to form. So in a perfect world, we would be able to determine with absolute certainty when a bloom is about to form, so we can tell the right people to close a lake and then keep anyone from ever getting exposed. But since they are so hard to predict, we have to take a very reactionary approach to the problem and just try to identify a bloom as soon as we possibly can. And even this can be difficult to do since they can form in a matter of hours. So if you take a look at these two pictures at the bottom of this slide, these were both taken at the same location on Vancouver Lake, only 5 hours apart, back in August 2020. And you can see a drastic change in the amount of cyanobacteria scum. So without constant lake surveillance, it can be really difficult to detect these blooms early.
Sorry.
Are
you okay?
However, a great tool that's currently being developed to aid in this problem is the Cyanobacteria Assessment Network, or CIAN for short. This is a national multi-agency project with people from the EPA, NASA, NOAA, and USGS all collaborating. The goal of CIAN is to develop an early warning indicator system to detect algal blooms in freshwater systems. So we hope to be able to use this to detect blooms sooner before they become an even bigger threat to human health. There's a lot of really interesting science and math behind this project, but the main premise is that cyanobacteria have unique pigments that can be detected and measured with special satellite instruments. Now, this is a very new technology with a lot of research still to be done, but it's certainly a promising tool that we're really hoping to implement in the future with our CMH program. Additionally, the EPA has a web-based platform called CIAN App that allows anyone to access the data collected through the Cyanobacteria Assessment Network. Here I have a couple of screenshots that just show the functionality of the app. On the left, we have the three locations where we routinely sample when there's a bloom at Vancouver Lake. And then on the right-hand side is just a map of Vancouver Lake with those three locations pinned. These three circles, it gives the estimated cell count at each location in cells per milliliter of water. And then directly next to that, it tells you how much that value has changed since the last time the satellite took an image of that part of the lake. So it really is a very intuitive and user-friendly way to monitor the presence of cyanobacteria. And so using CIAN, we were able to get access to data starting in May 2016 all the way to present day. And during that range, there were a total of a little more than 400 days when the satellite picked up some kind of cyanobacteria presence on the lake. It is important to note that currently Vancouver Lake is the only lake in Clark County for which this type of data can be collected, and I'll explain why in a couple slides. So for each day when the satellite detected cyanobacteria, we recorded a cell count at the Vancouver Lake Swim Beach, the Flushing Channel, and the Shilluku Wildlife Area. We also recorded the maximum cell count on the lake, wherever that might have been. And even though we only had data for 400 days, in reality, there were probably many more days when there was some measurable amount of cyanobacteria on the lake. However, things like cloud cover and even wildfire smoke on those days pretty much make it almost impossible to capture an image that gives any useful data. So that does definitely pose a challenge for the consistency of using this tool. Next, we used historical records based on actual site visits that we made to determine for which of those days a bloom was present on Vancouver Lake and which days there was no bloom. And then we compared these two categories to see if the satellite data could be verified by in situ observations. In general, we expected to see higher cell counts on the days when there was a bloom, which would give us evidence that the satellite imaging is a useful tool for figuring out when a bloom is formed. So now I'm going to show some of the results that we found. First, we plotted the cyanobacteria cell count trend for each year from 2016 to 2021. So here is just 2016, which really only showed one major spike in cyanobacteria around the beginning of August. And then 2017 showed a fairly similar trend. Once we get to 2018, things do kind of start to pick up a little bit. And then we have 2019, 2020, and what data we do have so far for 2021. From this figure, you might just be tempted to assume that the frequency and severity of algal blooms is getting worse each year. And while that certainly may be the case for these select years, the factors that make blooms more likely, especially increasing temperature from climate change, occur on a much larger time scale than 6 years. So it is risky to make this causal relationship. It will probably take several more years of data to determine if there is a trend of increasing bloom frequency and what is causing it. One of the things we can see from this figure, though, is the seasonality of blooms. Cyanobacteria counts are highest during the summer and early fall months, which coincides with our monitoring season when we test for cyanotoxins. So it was good to see that the images being taken closely match what we see in the field in terms of when blooms are occurring. This next figure goes back to what I mentioned about categorizing each day as bloom present or no bloom present. On the x-axis, you can see the average cell count, which ranges anywhere from 0 all the way to 2.4 million cells per milliliter. On the y-axis, it shows the percentage of days when there was a bloom versus when there is no bloom on Vancouver Lake. So for example, if you take a look at this very first bar on the far left, when the cell count was between 0 and 200,000, for the vast majority of those days, there was no bloom on Vancouver Lake, which makes sense because the cell count was so small. And then as you move to the right, as the cell count increases, the proportion of days when a bloom was present gradually increases as well. And then once you get above 1.6 million cells per milliliter, there is a bloom present on 100% of those days. So this is really good information for us to have, because let's say we check the most recent CyanApp data and see that the cell count is somewhere between 1.2 and 1.4 million cells per milliliter. That essentially means that there is approximately a 75% chance that a bloom is present at Vancouver Lake. So knowing this, we would probably go out and do a site visit and then collect water samples to test for toxicity. So moving forward, the Swim Beach program is really hoping to implement this kind of data into their harmful algal bloom response protocol. For example, like I just mentioned, we can set a threshold cell count and be automatically notified when the numbers are above this value. This would allow for earlier detection of algal blooms and less reliance on notifications from the public, which all of this supports our goal of issuing advisories as soon as we can to better protect public health. Another way we can use this data is to go back in time and see if there is an instance when cyanobacteria counts were unusually high, but there was no bloom that was ever reported. And this would support our messaging to the public about the importance of notifying us if they see what may be a harmful algal bloom at a lake. There are certainly drawbacks to this satellite technology. First of all, the resolution at which the satellite captures images really limits our use of this tool on smaller lakes in Clark County. So at the moment, with the technology that's being used, the 300 meter spatial resolution only gives accurate data for Vancouver Lake. There are a few data points for Lacamas and Round Lake, but the latest ones are from 2020 and they're very sporadic. Additionally, like I mentioned earlier, environmental conditions such as cloud cover and wildfire smoke can make it difficult to capture an image for every single day. Because of this, we probably won't ever be able to solely rely on this method for detecting blooms. So instead, we're thinking of this more just as another tool in our toolbox for detecting blooms as soon as possible, which means we very much still rely on the public to notify us of potential blooms. And then if you are curious, this webpage here is the best place to report a bloom or any kind of health concern. And then one of the really cool things about CyAN is that everything is publicly available for anyone to access. So here I have a link to the CyAN web app if you're interested in checking it out yourself. They have data for the entire United States, so it's very interesting to look at and play around with. And then if you have an Android phone, you can also take out your camera and scan this QR code as well to download the app on your phone. And with that, thank you so much for your time, and I'll open it up for any comments and or questions that anyone has.
Thank you, Kelly, and thank you, Lisa. We might have some questions out there. You called for questions. Do we have anyone that has just wishes to share what they might know about this themselves, or experience that you've had making a report, or questions that you have for Kelly or for Lisa?
Kelly, this is Roxanne. I have a question. When do you expect, or is there some timeline when this will be available for other? Right now, I think you said it's available for Vancouver Lake right now. Is that what I heard?
Right.
When do you anticipate it'll be available for other bodies of water in our area?
I am not sure of that. The main reason why is because, for example, Lacamas Lake, Around Lake, or Battleground Lake, they're just physically too small that the satellite can't really, like, capture an image that is that detailed. So that's the reason why. So if the Cyan project in the future decides to upgrade what kind of technology they're using, it could be possible, but I'm not sure currently.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Paul. I have a question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Are you connected with other states that are doing this with you? And the reason I ask that is one of my coworkers had mentioned this only a few days ago to me about worrying about taking her dogs to a body of water in Oregon, and she had read about the algae that was being formed and was afraid to not, you know, bring her dogs there. So do you connect through other states about what is happening in their states?
That's a good question. I don't know if we do too much of that. Alyssa, if you wanted to chime in on anything, if you had.
Yeah, so our part of, so it's really awesome, and we're really lucky in Washington in that we have a state freshwater harmful algal bloom monitoring program, which is really unique to us. There's not a lot of other states that support local health jurisdictions or even like private citizens to sample harmful algal bloom and test for toxicity. So because we're part of this state program, we do work closely with Oregon. Utah is another state that has a really robust harmful algal program, or California has another robust harmful algal bloom monitoring program. So we do talk with other states. Like, for example, we were made aware of the bloom on the Willamette River from our partners through Public Works. And so we are going to be providing some information about that in our newsletter and reminding people to keep their pets away from harmful algal blooms. In our weekly newsletter, we do a lot of messaging to veterinarians, especially because dogs are such a vulnerable population to the very serious side effects of harmful algal bloom toxins. For example, a very sad story last week, 3 dogs in Spokane died due to a harmful algal bloom, and that is why there was a recent press release from the Washington State Department of Health reminding everyone, whenever you have your pets near a body of water, always be cautious, always check before letting them go first, as they are very curious. And so we do work a lot with our partners. Obviously, more messaging could be done. And if you ever want more messaging from us, I would love to be in your inbox every Friday, Paul, providing, you know, the latest water quality information. Because we do have a lot of information for pet owners, especially in those, because dogs, like I mentioned, and like I'll always mention, are especially susceptible to harmful algal bloom and cytotoxin poisoning.
Thank you for the information, and I'd like to get your connection with my email. That would be great. Thank you, Alyssa.
So what I can do is I'll drop the link in the chat for where you can sign up on our website for the newsletter. All you have to do is put in your email, and then you'll be automatically signed up to receive our scheduled newsletters every Friday.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if we could add that information to the minutes somehow, if that would be acceptable to do, so that people who want to get it later on, they'll have a way of finding it.
Yes, this is Doreen. I'll be happy to add it to the minutes. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any other questions for our presenters?
This is Janice. I don't really have a question, but I just want to thank Kelly and Alyssa, but especially Kelly, for that great presentation. We are so lucky. We get such outstanding interns. And Kelly, you're not even in Washington, are you?
I am not. So I'll be a senior this year at the University of Georgia. So I'm doing a virtual internship out of Athens, Georgia.
Yeah. And we are so lucky, and it's really, you can imagine, to do an internship remotely, the challenges, and Kelly has just done an amazing job, as you can see by that project, and Alyssa has done a wonderful job mentoring him, and then Brian Schlottman, who's hiding behind the camera, I see his name,
is the program manager for the Rec Water program, which has really grown in the last year and really expanded. So thank you all for all your great work. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much for having us. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much for taking time to present here. It is very informative. That a lot of what you talked about was brand new information for me. So I really appreciate it knowing that so I can get with my kids and tell them to watch out for our granddogs. Thank you so much. Hope to hear from you again. Good job. Okay. Then we'll go ahead and take back the screen and get ready for the next presentation. Next, we will have from our Department of Public Health would be a budget update that Jeff Harbison will be presenting for us tonight.
Thank you. Jeff Harbison, Administrative Services Director with Clark County Public Health. So our Clark County is now on an annual budget cycle. Our 2022 budget was submitted August 3rd, 1 week ago, today, which included all of our operational needs for 2022, including our environmental public health fees, updates to that. We had no reductions for 2022, which was a nice change after suffering reductions for 2021's budget. The final 2021 budget supplemental is due a week from yesterday, Monday the 16th. This is an opportunity to adjust our budget to reflect any revenues or expenditures that have not been captured thus far in our budget. For this cycle, it's mostly going to reflect our COVID response effort funding and expenses. The state had awarded a $7.5 million grant early on in this year and pulled that back to replace it with federal funding. We've since received FEMA funding, several other federal funding sources. We need to make sure that all of that is in our annual budget for 2021. Simultaneously, I'm also working with the rest of our leadership team. The county has received $95 million of American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, funding. We had submitted a request proposal for numerous projects in July. The process has been adjusted slightly. I'm working with the rest of our leadership team to submit our final request. It's due next Monday as well, August 16th. Our initial ask was for numerous projects totaling $8.8 million over the three-year ARPA cycle. We're adding a project, at least one project, and again, that's due next Monday. So that'll be a fairly substantial ask. Last but not least, we are also working on a prioritized use of our Foundational Public Health Services, or FPHS, state grant funding. The state legislature approved their biennial budget, their biennium starts July 1st, so a little over a month ago, and in that biennial budget included expansion of FPHS funding for local public health. We're working on use of what we expect to be coming our way. Once we get formal contract notice, which should happen in September, we hope, we'll submit a staff report to the county to reflect use of those funds. So we've got numerous budgeted projects going on simultaneously. That's the budget update. I guess one minor piece, periphery to the budget is, the environmental public health fees, and we'll be bringing forward our environmental public health fee schedule ordinance. The Board of Health has to approve the 2022 fees in ordinance form. That'll happen at our October Board of Health meeting in advance of the 2022 budget being approved. We expect November 17th by the County Council. That's the last step in approving that 2022 annual budget for the county. So if there are any questions on our budget process or any other pieces I talked about, I went through fairly quickly, but we got a lot of moving parts going on right now with our budget.
Oh, I have a question, Jeff, and that is, what might we do as the Public Health Advisory Council to support these plans that you've made, the requests that are out there, and the funds that are needed to go forward with these important initiatives?
That is a fantastic question. We've, thus far in the budget process, we've received pretty good support from our counselors. We've gotten, we don't have any reductions. We haven't gotten any pushback on our environmental public health fee schedule. They were engaged throughout that process. We had one-on-ones and then a work session with them. They were supportive of our efforts. One of the pieces I didn't mention, it's more granular, is we're adding a process in which we'll start building a fund balance to replace our environmental public health permitting system. We're in the process right now of replacing that system. One of our ARPA requests is for funding to support that replacement. Well, in 10 or 15 years, ARPA most likely won't be around, so we're going to start building up a fund balance to replace the new system then. It's much easier to take very, very small nibbles and build up enough fund balance to replace that versus asking for, you know, $1.5 to $2 million in 10 or 12 years. We've actually received pretty good support this year. Had we needed support around our fee schedule, or if we were asked to make reductions, there may have been an opportunity for us to engage FAC, and which we have done in the past. But this time so far, knock on wood, it's gone fairly well. Excellent question, Marla.
Hey, Jeff, this is Joan. I have a question. After so many years of, it's almost decades of underfunding of public health, and now with, you know, the foundational public health, where do you see public health as we move forward into the future getting the funding that we need to do the work that we've outlined to work? I mean, I don't think our efforts should stop right now. So what are your thoughts about where we're headed in the future and what we can do about that? That this isn't the hurrah, we've done it. I mean, this is just step one, I believe.
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent question, Joan. You know, we've heard some areas around the state, there's some fears about county councils or county commissioners pulling back local support in response to the pretty good, growth in the state funding, FPHS funding. We don't see that coming. I agree. The FPHS expansion still was not the full need for the health system. Alan probably wants to speak a little bit to some of this. I think there's so many moving parts of that, and that is a great question, Joan. Alan, do you want to speak to that?
Unmute myself. So, you know, we're just getting started here. The public health system has been underfunded for so long, and, you know, this is a gradual increase, and there are a lot of different segments of the system that are, you know, are underfunded, and, you know, including the state, our tribal health departments, local health departments. We've got, you know, the pandemic itself. So, you know, I agree, Joan, that it's a work in progress. And, you know, what we asked for when we estimated what the needs were, we're still only getting a portion of that, even though it's a significant chunk of money. It's still a fraction or a proportion of what we determine were the gaps in the system. So we have a ways to go yet.
Yeah, we can't lay down and just say, you know, it's a good year, we've got adequate funding. It's just like, because, you know, as time goes by, it's like we become invisible again, and that can't happen.
Well, I have a question about the, and I know you're going to talk some more about this, so if you're going to cover this aspect of it, I'll stop and you can tell me to wait. But the House Bill 1152, I'm just wondering if some of the language in there is going to be supportive of this growth in, hopefully growth in the funding and moving us toward a more permanent solution, so it's not this panic every single year. And so if, is that something that will be mentioned when we talk about the House Bill 1152?
Well, so 1152 wasn't the funding itself. That was separate. 1152 is a long story, and I don't want to take a whole lot of time with it this evening, but what's left, so 1152 wasn't the actual amount that was allocated. It was around restructuring the public health system, and there are implications for fact that I think we've spoken about and we'll talk about when we go to the bylaws, but 1152 itself doesn't provide funding.
I knew that, but I wondered if...
And actually, now that I'm... Yeah. I'm sorry, Marla. I've got some concerns about how this played out as well, because it's not in statute or 1152, but the original 1152 included this whole system, this whole set of regional public health districts that seemed like another... They were going to put a lot of money into it, and it was going to be another layer of government that many of us in local public health objected to. That was taken out of 1152, but there was a budget proviso added at the last moment that still put $3 million into creating these regional, I'm not sure what they are, regional centers. And, you know, there's still a lot of discussion that needs to go on around that. I'm sorry, I'm probably talking too much already.
No, that's helpful. I just wondered if, as with the restructure, there would be some dollars tied to it, otherwise it might feel like an unfunded mandate.
Yes.
You know, I think there's some other areas where we continue to be chronically underfunded, and that's like in our chronic disease prevention programs. And, you know, the very thing that will help us prevent some of the challenges we've been facing with trying to respond to the COVID pandemic. And, you know, that's really where it hurts, is because, you know, we're scrambling to support our community when these emergencies take place. And if we can build a structure where we're actually working on these chronic underlying problems in our community, you know, when these pandemics inevitably will happen, and it will happen again, we will have an opportunity to better respond, and respond in a way that is much more supportive of our community and what our community needs. And so I think ongoing, that's been the biggest struggle for us, is that, you know, like FPHS is wonderful, it's great, it's a great concept, but they continue to fund things that are mostly mandated services, you know, communicable disease, which is important, you know, and EPH, also very important. But again, it's a little bit more reactive. And so if we can keep working towards building the system where we're not so reactive anymore, that we really have a robust public health system, that's really where we need to get to. And I think that's where FAP can help us the most.
Very good, thank you. So, Jeff, did you have anything else to add?
Not at the moment. If there were any additional questions, though, I'm available to answer.
Any more questions?
No, I'm Mark Collier. I have a question, Jeff. On environmental public health fees, are there any increases, or what's kind of the average increase if there is, or... Because I know last year we had some fees went up quite a bit.
Good question. There were no large increases. I'm trying to log back into my system. There were no large increases. They were fairly incremental. In fact, I think, you know what I can talk about that I did not mention. One of the policy considerations that the council took up was we moved our water resource and protection fees to a 90-10 model. So the drinking water and on-site septic permitting programs went to a 90% cost recovery. For the on-site septic permitting program, that was actually a reduction from 95% to 90. So those fees are actually collectively slightly going down, I believe. And the drinking water, even going from 75% cost recovery to 90, was still a very small fee cut. So those fees in those programs went down. Sorry, I forgot to mention that policy decision that, the county council made, or Board of Health made, I guess.
Okay, thank you. I think Chuck's going to be talking with us next week at the TAC committee meeting on fees, too.
Yeah, I'll need to recalculate one last time after we account for all of the state FBHS funding. That'll actually adjust the fee slightly, as indirect shifts slightly. I expect fees to be a little bit lower than what Chuck has seen, but not much.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Jeff before we move on? Okay, hearing nothing. Then we'll move on to the director's report, and Dr. Melnick, you'll be leading us through that. Thank you.
I think if I remember correctly, it's about COVID-19 and 1152. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm having internet issues. I can't get to my... on my file. So let me see if I can get this loaded. Can you see that?
Not yet.
Can you see the COVID-19 update?
No, not yet. Not yet.
No?
There it is.
Okay, I don't know why I'm having problems here.
There we go, Alan. We see it now.
It says screen sharing, but it's...
Okay, we saw it.
You got it now?
Well, we did. It went away.
Okay, hold on. It's really, let me try one other. Can you see it now? No?
We have it.
Let me try something else.
Oh.
No, that's not working.
Yeah, there it is.
Okay, let me make sure this is the right one. Yep, okay. You can see that okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so let me go through this. I have two screens here, and it really kind of does a funny... You see it as a slideshow now? Now it looks better. Okay. So I'm going to take you through a really brief COVID-19 update, and then I'll briefly mention 1152, because I think we've talked about that before. And I don't have any slides on that, thankfully, so I'll see if I can... Okay, that's... So right now we're heading in a really bad direction with COVID-19. So the case numbers are surging not only in the state, but also in Clark County, and hospitalizations are increasing everywhere. Early last week, the state health department reported 1,500 new cases per day over 4 days. Our hospital occupancy is at the highest levels so far this entire year, and that includes, you know, what we saw in the winter and in the spring. Last Tuesday, across the state, more than 600 people were hospitalized with COVID-19, significant increase from the week before. And, you know, one of the numbers I share with you and I share with the Board of Health is the reproductive number, or the R-naught. And the R-naught, the reproductive number, is the number of people that one person transmits the disease to, the number of people infecting one person. And if it's over one, if it's under one, the outbreak of the pandemic is decreasing. If it's over one, it's increasing. And the more it is over one, it becomes exponential. So if one person infects, here it is, one person infects 1.46 other people, then you do the math, and 1.46 times 1.46 and so on, and you get exponential increase. So this is, since the beginning of the pandemic last year, when it first started, the R-naught was really high, and then you could see we went through areas where it actually got below, you know, in the winter, we were like high numbers here. We got lower, we went up in the spring surge, went down, and now you can see here we are where the reproductive numbers is basically as high as it's been through some of the worst points of the pandemic. So that's what we're seeing now. In Clark County, where the case numbers are increasing significantly, so a month ago we were having 20 cases per day. And then like last week, we were seeing about close to 90 cases a day. And over the weekend, we average 115 cases a day. So it's continuing to go up. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we averaged 115 cases. And if we continue to do that, our rate per, you know, that metric of that rate per 100,000 over 14 days would be over 300, which is really, really high. It's close to what we were seeing at the that third wave that was really high. It's even worse around us. Calhoun County has been recently up to 50 cases a day. Actually, I think they had 100 cases per day, which would put them, you know, at over 1,000 per 100,000 over 14 days. So the metric we use, you know, we look back to see the cases per 100,000 over 14 days, and the rate last week, you know, was 121. But we're all well above that now if we count it up to the present day. Our hospitalizations are up also. You want to have fewer than 10% of beds occupied by COVID-19 patients, and we're up to 12.6% of hospital beds occupied by COVID patients. And right now we've got 69 cases and four persons under investigation for COVID-19, so suspects. And we're approaching the, you know, the range in the 80s that we were at the height of the pandemic. You want the admissions to be below 5 for 100,000 over 7 days, and we've exceeded that now. We're at 6.2. So things are heading in a really bad direction. Sorry for the gloom and doom. This is the activity level. You can see this is the winter when we got pretty high. Then we had this spring surge, and now we're this is way back to July. It's worse now, than those numbers are going up even further. The other point I want to make is, you know, the best way out of this, my internet connection is unstable, so I hope you don't lose me. Can you still hear me okay? Okay, I see a couple of heads nodding. Some of you are frozen there. The way out of this is to get people vaccinated. As you can see here, this is a hospital admission data for unvaccinated people compared to vaccinated folks. So the red line is, you know, we just started providing vaccinations in the late winter here, or midwinter, and the red line is the hospitalization rate in unvaccinated people. And the green line here is the hospitalization rate in fully vaccinated people. It took a while for people to become fully vaccinated because you need those, you know, for Pfizer and Moderna, you need those two doses. For people who are 45 to 64 years of age, the rate of hospitalization in unvaccinated people is 20 times higher than those who are vaccinated. And for people over 65, it's 9 times higher. So even though we're seeing a few breakthrough infections and people have been vaccinated, the bottom line is the most compelling reason for anybody to get vaccinated is to prevent severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And the vaccines are incredibly effective, as you can see here, on doing that. They also do reduce infection and prevent transmission. So we need to get vaccinated to protect others around us as well. We've been partnering to look with Calhoun County and other counties in Southwest Washington to take a look at what's happening regionally around hospitalizations, not just statewide. And we found, even looking at the regional data, that the vaccination is reducing the risk of severe illness. And even those partially vaccinated are receiving some protection, although you really should get fully vaccinated, not only to further protect yourself, but to help reduce the emergence of resistant variants as well. But for people 65 and older, the risk of being hospitalized for COVID-19 was reduced by 90% compared to unvaccinated folks, was reduced by 90% of those for those fully vaccinated, and 75% of those who are partially vaccinated. They also looked at the vaccination status of middle-aged adults here, 45 to 64, who are vaccinated. And of the 61,620 people in that age group in Southwest Washington who were vaccinated, fewer than 10 were hospitalized for COVID-19. Pretty small number.
And the other, the hospitalization data shows that 91% of hospitalized folks in Southwest Washington were unvaccinated. That compares to them being 49% of the total population in that age group. So they work not only in clinical trials, but also in real life. A new weekly report from DOH shows the impact of COVID-19 on people who are unvaccinated. So from February through July 24th, more than 94% of cases in the state, 94% of cases, deaths, and hospitalizations in people 12 years and older were among those not fully vaccinated. So 96.5% of cases were in those who are not fully vaccinated. 96% of hospitalizations were in those not fully vaccinated, and 94.6% of deaths were in those who are not fully vaccinated. More evidence, I know I'm hammering this, but more evidence that the vaccine works. The vaccines work, I should say. Okay, the question came up about variants. I'm going to try to answer this question not only about variants, but variants broken down by age group, which is, I think, was the question asked earlier. One of the reasons we're heading down this wrong path is that the emergence of the Delta variant, which is significantly more transmissible than earlier strains of the virus. And people with this Delta variant have 1,000 times the amount of virus in their airways, in their, like, their nasopharynx, as people with previous strains. So it's very transmissible. And the CDC estimates that it's as transmissible as a chickenpox, which is significant. It probably causes more severe illness than earlier strains. I mean, we're still looking at that, and concerns about younger populations as well. And you might have seen the news about hospitalizations increasing across the United States, not only for elderly folks, but for children and younger adults as well. The other concern about the Delta variant, although the vaccines are really effective against it, some antibody treatments may be less effective for it, and there's some evidence that the antibodies produced by vaccination are less effective in the laboratory against the Delta variant, but in real life, the vaccines still significantly, highly protect against hospitalization and death from the Delta variant. Here it is about chickenpox. It's more transmissible than Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. And, you know, remember the first SARS. Those are coronaviruses, by the way. But it's also more transmissible than the common cold, Ebola, seasonal flu. And I'm not sure about smallpox, but it's as transmissible as chickenpox. The prevalence of the Delta variant is increasing in the United States and in Washington State. It's predominant here. Now, it seems like a small amount. It says only 10 Delta variant cases have been identified in Clark County, but that's only because we sequence a small proportion of the total number of cases. Here's a graphic to show what's happened in the U.S. going back to May, and now this is late July here. And the Delta variant, so the Alpha variant, that UK variant, was taking over in April and May. It was more transmissible than earlier strains. And you could see that the Delta variant, which is this orange here, is even more transmissible than the Alpha variant. And the orange is the Delta variant is crowding everything else out. Because it transmits more efficiently and it grows, it replicates more efficiently than other viruses. So other variants of the of COVID-19. So 1 month ago, 54% of cases in the U.S. were attributed to the Delta variant, and 2 weeks ago, 72% of cases were attributed to that. And as of the end of July, the CDC estimates that the Delta variant is responsible for 83% of cases in the United States. In Washington State, actually, the model, actually, you know, earlier it got up to 85%, but the model says, you know, we don't have the exact numbers yet. This light blue is a Delta variant that is actually responsible for over 92% of COVID-19 cases in the state. And this is broken
broken down by age groups. So these are the demographics and clinical characteristics of Delta variant cases. And we have, you know, only a small number of the cases are sequenced, so we don't have complete breakdowns here. But and also realize that this is throughout the entire year. So, but you can see that you know, the Delta variant has recently become more predominant. But it the percent, so it's only a small number of cases are sequenced. But you can see that the Delta variant is responsible for a significant number of cases here. Less so in the elderly groups, but I, you know, part of that may be that those folks are got vaccinated earlier than the other groups, and we've seen less Delta variant compared to, you know, right now the largest number of cases that we're seeing are in younger younger adults. So based on what's happening with the Delta variant, the CDC has updated its guidance on face covering. So again, the vaccines are effective at preventing infection or transmission, but a small proportion of people who are fully vaccinated can get the can get a breakthrough infection, and that could be, you know, the Delta variant more likely now. And the problem is that those folks may be asymptomatic. But even asymptomatic infections with the Delta variant in people who are vaccinated, they can transmit this as well as people who are unvaccinated. So that's one of the reasons behind the recommendations on universal masking in public, because people with, even those who are vaccinated, can transmit the infection, even if they're asymptomatic. They're less likely to get infected, but they still can get infected. The vaccine isn't 100% effective. The other reason for the recommendation on face coverings is that in public places, it's very difficult in large public places to verify vaccination status, if not impossible. We're basically on the honor system, and there's a large number of people. And, you know, if you're out and about, you can see there's a large number of people who are unmasked, probably out of proportion to the number of people who are vaccinated in the population. So concerns about, you know, unvaccinated in large public places, you can't tell who's vaccinated and who's not. And that's a concern as well around those recommendations. Given the current virus activity in Clark County, we're recommending face coverings for everyone in indoor settings. That's consistent with the CDC recommendations, as well as the Washington Department of Health recommendations. And right now, virus activity is currently categorized as high. DOH, State Health Department, just updated guidance for schools and now requires all students and staff coming into the fall to wear face coverings. And again, that's in alignment with the CDC, as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics. And that's a legal requirement from the state. The school's response it's a mandate, it's a requirement. And neither public health nor local school districts have the ability to require something less than universal masking. And, you know, speaking to the superintendents in the school and hearing what they're saying, I believe that the school boards throughout the region will be on board anyway in terms of universal masking recommendations. The other issue is the fact that we still have a fairly large proportion of people who are eligible to be vaccinated in Clark County that are under vaccinated. So if you look at people who've initiated vaccination, you know, the one dose of Pfizer or Moderna, if you include that, you know, people started, have had at least one dose, only 53% of Clark County residents, 12 and above, those are the overall 53% of Clark County residents have had one dose. That includes all ages. If you look at 12 and older, those are the people who are eligible to get the vaccine. 62% of Clark County residents 12 years and older have just initiated a vaccination. In terms of fully vaccinated, 48%, only 48% of the entire population has completed vaccination. That counts everyone. But if you look at people who are eligible, 12 and older for the vaccine, we're 56% of Clark County residents eligible for the vaccine have been fully vaccinated. If you look at the 16 and older, it's still below 6%. So 40% of the population 16 in Clark County is not fully vaccinated. So we have a large susceptible population. Accordingly, because of the low vaccination rate and because of what we're seeing across the state, the governor announced new COVID-19 vaccine requirements for state employees and workers in healthcare and healthcare settings and long-term care facilities. It's now a condition of employment in those settings, and they have until October 18th to get fully vaccinated. Some exceptions are considered, but only for legitimate medical reasons. And honestly, the medical exemptions for these vaccines are really, really rare. And there's a or for religious, sincerely held religious reasons, you can get an exemption. There is no personal or philosophic exemptions available for this, no test out option. State employees under other elected officials, not the governor, are not included. So for example, OSBI, the state, the Office of State of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, those employees are not covered by this because OSBI superintendent is separately elected. It's not under the governor. But I've heard there's been some talk from OSBI that they may be looking at that. But this is not a requirement in schools yet. King County and the City of Seattle also announced vaccine mandates for their employees. Washington State grows, you know, what the governor did is not not acting alone. There's a number of organizations that have done this. You can see federal employees, New York City and California requiring vaccinations for their employees. A number of healthcare settings, Kaiser, East Health, Legacy, Vancouver Clinic are now all requiring vaccinations for their staff. The VA, the State Medical Association, the American Hospital Association have issued statements supporting mandates for healthcare workers. And you can see here, I won't read the list, but private businesses are also beginning to require employees to be vaccinated, as well as customers who come into their space to be vaccinated. And in Seattle, you can see that there are more than 60 restaurant bars, and the same thing is beginning to happen in Portland. I just wanted to mention our vaccination efforts. So we were doing vaccinations early on, you know, when the vaccine became available. We had a number of pods. The locations are listed there. They included the Tower Mall site. We went to adult family homes, long-term care facilities, housing authority, food processing facilities. And one of the things, you know, the concerns all along with this, with the pandemic is BIPOC populations have been hit hard by the pandemic. And the number of cases, the proportion of cases in the Latinx population in Clark County is around, I believe, 25-30%, even though that population is about 10% of the population of the county. We had large outbreaks. You might recall at the at food processing plants where a lot of the staff, a lot of the employees are of BIPOC populations, and one of the ways to reach those populations was to provide vaccine at some of the food processing facilities. So we went to a number of those. And also locations that would be helpful in get more likely to reach those populations, like the Tower Mall location. We had a Type 1 incident management team arrive in that's a federal level incident management team. They transitioned to a regional / local team here in midwinter. You can see the number of doses that we administered, Clark County, Calhoun County, and Skamania County through these sites. And then we demobilized our incident management team on June 30th after giving a little bit over 61,000 vaccinations. We used a number of staff, a large number of public health staff. When we talk about foundational public health services and being prepared, a lot of these staff, we don't have a whole lot of surge capacity in our department, and we were staff from various other parts of our health department. For example, environmental public health staff were called in to do some of this work. We also had contracted staff as temporary employees and a lot of volunteers, including the Medical Reserve Corps and the Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT. And you could see that among public health staff, 17,000 hours there, but if you look at the volunteers, over 9,000 hours. And then we had to bring in contracted and temporary employees to do this work, over 32,000, almost 33,000 hours there. And that doesn't include the work of City of Vancouver, Safeway, the partners there, Calhoun County staff that worked at these sites. And you can see the number of staff and volunteers who were called into this. Overall, 535 staff and volunteers worked close to 60,000 hours on the response. And I think that's the end of this slideshow. So I don't know if folks have any questions about my latest COVID-19 report.
Helen, do you have a dollar amount for all of those hours?
That's a really, really good question, Joan. I'm trying to remember, and I remember the, you know, when we look back at the measles, which was a fraction of this, we were in the millions. That's a really good question. You know, something we might, I think would be worthwhile. And I don't have Jeff here. I think he got off, but we can totally, oh, you're there? Okay, Jeff, do you have
I just think that would be an incredibly educational tool for the public to understand the cost that it takes. And I just think I think it would be worth it to figure it out. And then also to get the other jurisdictions to chip in what they have. I just think that the cost of this community is just horrendous. And I think that would be a very interesting piece of information to share then with the community and our policymakers.
You know, we published that for the measles outbreak, the cost of the measles outbreak, but with the CDC. But Jeff, I'm sorry, I talked okay. over you.
I can't give you a figure right now because I have not looked in a while. We do have account segments set up, though, to actually track the cost specific to the response. In fact, we got it broken down between the mass vaccination separate from the case investigation and the contact tracing. So we will definitely be able to report data at some point.
Wow, that's fabulous.
I think the one thing that I'd like to add is... Andy, were you talking?
Yeah, but it's okay. You can go ahead and finish.
No, you have good connection now. I'll hold.
Okay, so my question is, do you know currently if you need to be, if you have to have a signed waiver strictly from your parents to get vaccinated, or is there like a certain age that you can be, that you can just go? I've heard from multiple people that I've said that they do want to get vaccinated, but the only reason they can't is because their parents won't let them.
That is a great question.
Is there any information on that right now?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And by the way, it differs from state to state. So Oregon, for example, has a law that a statute that the legislature passed that allows adolescents to get vaccinated without parental consent. In Washington state, it's based on case law. So the legislature didn't pass a law, but there's been cases on this. And it falls into what's called the mature minor doctrine. So, and I believe it's 16 and older, but I'm not, Andy, I got to check on that for you. But what we're doing at vaccination sites in Clark County is for the 12 to 15 year olds, we required a parental consent, and I believe the parents needed to be present for that. For the 16 and 17 year olds, while requested consent, the 16 and 17 year olds could use the mature minor doctrine, which means that in Washington state, if the healthcare provider, in this case it included the nurses who were doing intake when people came in to be vaccinated, if they felt the 16 or 17 year old was mature enough based on just talking to them, basically on talking to them, to make that decision, they were able to administer the vaccine without parental consent. So certainly that can happen for 16. I know for sure for 16 and 17 year olds in Washington. I'll have to double check with our attorney about younger kids. Does that answer it, Andy? Or
all right, thank you.
You may be on mute.
Yeah, that does a really good job at explaining it, because it really be difficult to, like...
I'm sorry, you broke up there.
It's very difficult to hear about people wanting to get... Can you hear me?
I'm wondering if you could put it in the chat, if you could type it in. But I think what I heard you say, it's difficult to hear is Andrea, is that me breaking up or Andy breaking up? Okay, so Andy, I think what I heard is that it's difficult to hear about young people whose parents are not providing consent and keeping them from getting vaccinated. Is that what you were saying, or something in the chat? Okay, that's what you were saying. Were these 16 and 17 year olds who were saying that, or younger people? I will double check. I don't know if anybody on this, any of my colleagues have the answer to this, but I will double check about 15 year olds for you. I know the 16 and 17 year olds can get vaccinated without parental consent. They can invoke the mature minor doctrine. That I'm pretty sure about. I don't know about 15 year olds, and I'll double check that.
That's correct, Alan.
Am I right?
That's correct.
16, 17. Okay. I think it's tragic. I mean, you know, and there's been a lot of politics around this. You might have recalled during the measles outbreak, there was a, I don't know if it was in Washington state, but there was a young man who, it wasn't in Washington state because we have the mature minor doctrine. It was on the news, but as soon as he turned 18, he got the vaccine, but his parents wouldn't let him. And I think there's a lot of kids who are really, I mean, if you look at the spring, some data from the CDC that adolescent hospitalizations increased, and COVID-19 is not, adolescents are not immune to to complications from COVID-19. And I could understand a 16 to 17 year old or 15 year old or somebody younger than that who really want to get vaccinated as soon as it's available, including 12 year olds. And unfortunately, you know, that's there have been a lot of challenges there, including there continue to be challenges there.
I hear you say that the vaccinations have been mobilized in this Delta variant time.
Yes. So what happened was, we were doing the vaccinations and doing incident management team when the vaccine was in short supply and the demand was high and we needed to get vaccinations out to people. Towards June, what happened, unfortunately, is, and this is a matter of our bandwidth as well, what happened by the time we get to June, unfortunately, is that the demand for vaccinations really dropped off. So being able to put together a pod like what we had at Tower Mall, you know, we were doing over 1,000 vaccines today, and it really, in June, by the end of June, it was down to a trickle. I mean, we were having really difficulty doing that, and that was true at some of the other vaccination sites as well. And at the same time, a lot of vaccine became available, and it's basically free all over the county. Pharmacies, healthcare providers had vaccine available, and even there, and this is true not just in Washington State and Clark County, this is true around the country, even then, even with vaccine freely available, the demand for it really diminished. So the amount of resources to put into continuing to do these pods, and I'll let my colleagues chime in. Roxanne was an incident commander on this, and I know Andrea worked in operations chief in this response, and Janice is on, Janice's ops chief. What happened was the amount of resources to do this and the amount of demand, it just, we didn't have the bandwidth, and it wasn't efficient to keep doing that, and we really do rely on our healthcare provider partners to provide vaccine. Before the pandemic, we were not involved in vaccine delivery. We don't, our health department doesn't have a vaccination administration program as one of our programs. So we were doing this during the pandemic when supply was limited and demand was high. I don't know, Janice, Andrea, Roxanne, if you want to add anything to that.
Dr. Miller, I'd like to jump in too. But one of the things too that I just wanted to mention was that a lot of the IMT staff members also were contractors or volunteers from our fire teams. And so, you know, once we started hitting, you know, fire season, we started having, you know, some real staffing challenges as well. So in addition to, you know, the sort of the lack of demand, we also had a staffing issue. But I just also wanted to just let folks know that, you know, while we demobilized the vaccination part of our response, our ongoing case investigation and contact tracing is still continuing. So that part of the response continues to go very robust. We're continuing to do that. We have an outside contractor we're working with Public Health Institute to continue to do that work. And so when we have outbreaks in congregate settings, we're all over that. So that is still continuing to this day. The other thing that we've been doing is once we demobilize, we are still trying to coordinate with outside resources, Department of Health, for instance, to help to vaccinate homebound residents. We're trying to facilitate and coordinate some outside organizations to assist with unhoused populations, vaccinating unhoused populations and that sort of thing. So we're still in that sort of facilitation role, although we're no longer planning and standing up and staffing those pods. We are coordinating those still, our Medical Reserve Corps volunteers, to help with some of those efforts. So those are still the ongoing efforts that we're still doing today. And so those costs continue. So Joan, as we're looking at our costs, we're continuing to to spend money hand over fist every single day on this. So,
hey, Roxanne, I think we're working with Peace Health, Southwest Medical, Southwest Family Medicine Residency Program, LULAC, and the Vancouver School District to do a couple of, we're going to be doing some, and we're going to be providing Medical Reserve Corps and FEMA funding, I believe, to do some back a couple of days of vaccination at Vancouver, a couple of Vancouver school district high schools. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
One's a statement, and then I have one other question. I would imagine this data is like excellent data, and how are we communicating to the community like this really nuanced data that impacts, you know, the 45 to 65 year olds, the increase of the variant, the Delta variant in that group? How are we spending resources to communicate that and really get into the communities that are most disproportionately impacted by this variant? That's one question. Well, I guess I have two questions. And then the other question that I had was, given that like folks early on were vaccinated, you know, in January and February, like what's the efficacy rate of the vaccination? And what are we hearing about a potential booster for those folks who have been vaccinated earlier as we're hitting a spike in the Delta variant? And that's all of my questions. Thank you.
Those are two really good questions. I'm going to do the second question first, if that's okay. So right now, the CDC and the available evidence says that people still have a robust immunity 6 months after vaccination, and there's no CDC plan specifically around boosters. And you know, we're still studying that. And the other point I want to make, because this has come up, is that vaccination provides a more robust immunity than a natural infection. And I'll give you an example. There was just a CDC publication, MMWR, that showed people who had natural infection in 2020, the ones who were vaccinated had a much significantly lower incidence of breakthrough, you know, infection compared to folks who had previous natural infection, weren't vaccinated at all. So that the message still is, if you've had natural infection, you should get the vaccine. All that being said, I think there is discussion around potential for booster doses. I think if we see a booster a dose recommended, we'll probably see it for populations that might be at risk for lower vaccine efficacy, specifically people who are immunosuppressed, who might require a booster. But we're a ways from that. There's no, I know Pfizer recommended that, but looking at the data and hearing from the CDC and looking at the breakthrough rate is still really low. I mean, in Clark County, this is off the top of my head, the last I looked, it was about, we saw about 15 cases for every 10,000 people who are vaccinated. So the breakthrough rate is, you know, even at this point, you know, again, we're early on here, but I think we'll be hearing more news over that over the next several months. I think the other point I'd make about that is, I think that may be well and good, but, you know, I'm going to get to the first question you asked. Given that we have a large number, I think the low-hanging fruit on this, and that may be a poor term to use, would be to, you know, to get the population that's not vaccinated at all, to get them vaccinated first. So I don't know if that answers your question about boosters. It's a work in progress, and we'll probably have more information over the next few months as we gather more data. But we're really monitoring breakthrough infections pretty closely. And let me know if I didn't answer your question well enough, but the communication piece, I can go on and on and on about this. I think the communication piece has been the biggest challenge, and the politics around the vaccine and COVID-19 has probably been the biggest challenge. And we have a senior communication specialist, also our public information officer, who's really been getting out. You know, there's more to do, but we have an active social media presence with a high number of hits on Facebook, and I believe we do Twitter as well. So we're out on social media. We're getting out. There's a lot of information on our website. We're working with community partners to get some communication out there. We probably could do better about that, but the onslaught of misinformation around this and the political nature around, you know, the whole issue about individual rights versus the common good has been incredibly challenging on this. If any of you have suggestions, I mean, you know, FACT may be some help there, but any of you have suggestions on how we could communicate better? From what I've heard, the best way to get information out, given that the trust level is low, especially trust level low for government, is to actually have community members who have gotten the vaccine and who are associated with folks who are, you know, questioning it. That's maybe the most effective way to get the information out there. You know, that's why we did the I Got a Shot campaign. You know, I think a number of you participated in the I Got a Shot campaign, but, you know, having not people like me who are not trusted, Alan, but community members.
I have a question.
Yeah, Alan. Go ahead.
Did we get any members, people of faith in those shots?
I'm pretty sure we did. I wish we had Marissa on here. That's a really good point. I thought we had, but I can double check that.
Okay.
It's a great suggestion.
Yeah,
I mean,
just wondering, like,
you know, certainly, you know, about the misinformation around. Yeah.
So I was just wondering, like, you know, our faith leaders, whether or not they got vaccinated, and would they show up in those pictures? You know, that might, and we could post those or have those in the communities which people reside.
Yeah, I think for the BIPOC community, what I hear mostly people are anti-vaxxers who are just, I think their biggest fear, and what I'm hearing pretty consistently, is how quickly the vaccine came on the scene. And I know the science behind the vaccine is not, it's not a new thing. It's, you know, we've done it before, but I think that they are not early adapters or adopters to this particular vaccine. And it baffles me because, you know, and then there's like misinformation around, well, this person got the vaccine and they're kind of foggy or have leg cramps. I'm like, well, would you rather be foggy and leg cramps than to potentially lose your life with this vaccine? So there's a lot of communication around these particular fears in specific communities that I think communication strategies around could be effective.
Yeah, the piece about, and again, I'm probably not the most trusted person to give this message. The issue with the rollout of the vaccine, the difference here was not the clinical trials. The studies were just as robust as any other rollout. What happened here was, because of the pandemic, what happened was while the vaccines were being studied, the pharmaceutical companies were asked to manufacture large amounts of them. Now, that's a risk because if the vaccines in the clinical trials had been dangerous or not effective, the pharmaceutical companies would have had to destroy all that supply they made. But the belief was, and based on what we knew about these, you know, the studies have been done earlier, the pharmaceutical company ramped up the manufacture of large amounts at the same time the clinical studies were being done. Usually it's linear. Usually the manufacturing happens afterwards. When the clinical studies were completed, we had a large amount of vaccine ready to go. That was the idea. But getting that point across, especially from somebody like me, is very difficult. So having other members of the community, including, you know, like our BIPOC partners, to get this information out can be really helpful. And then, yeah, Andy has a point in the chat about the side effects. Yeah, yep. That that's why I'm hammering that, but we need to get, if you all have suggestions about getting the information out, and, you know, community partners who can help get the information out, that would be great. I think the communication is the biggest challenge.
So I have a thought from my experience at the Board of Health meeting where I think there was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 public people commenting. I read our letter, and so that was obviously in support of the work that public health's doing to try to increase vaccination rates. But everybody else was counter to that position. And the problem is, and Roxanne had to pull me off the ledge a little bit and remind me that it's maybe not a majority of people that are against getting vaccines, obviously, because more people are getting it than not. But the issue is they're well organized and very vocal. So what can we do? We can do what we can to speak our truth, you know, those of us who believe that it is a good thing and that it's really important for people to get the vaccine as soon as they can. So I'd be interested in maybe brainstorming. We're going to talk in a few minutes about getting a subcommittee, and maybe that can be part of it. But to just really dig down on what are some things that we can do that would help to counterbalance that small group of people that are very vocal and discouraging people from getting vaccines. That's one thing. And then you said something, Alan, about focusing on the folks that are, you know, the non-vaccinated. My most worry right now is the kids that are 5 to 11. So I'm comforted to know about the mask mandate for schools. But what about the kids that are in care, daycare, and preschool that are 0 to 5? They're at risk, and to my knowledge, daycares are not required to mask. So the kids don't mask at that age, but what about the adults that are taking care of them? Some voluntarily do, but is there any push to get those kids protected that you know?
For example, requiring staff of these daycare facilities to be, that's a really good, great question. They're regulated. Is it DCYF? That might be a conversation with our state partners on that in terms of licensed daycares. I know, you know, the reason why we can require, why the state can require long-term care facilities to be, for their staff to be vaccinated is because they're licensed by DSHS and the daycares are licensed as well. That's a really good question. That might be, I don't think that was included in the governor's proclamation, but I think that's something worth addressing. I think that's a really good point. And I'll bring it up with our, local public health partners and DOH from across the state. I think that's a good point, Marla.
Great. And I know that Kate Brown, Governor Brown in Oregon, had removed the mask mandate for daycares and preschools. I don't know if it has been changed, but that's not a good message.
No. But I hear that may be changing. I heard some rumors out of Oregon that some of the mask mandates might change.
I hope so.
This is Paul. Just an FYI, effective on this coming Friday, they have mandated in Multnomah County that everyone that goes into restaurants or grocery stores or et cetera wear a mask. That's a mandate. So that's effective this Friday.
Thanks, Paul. Other questions?
I just want to do a time check because I know we have some important business to that is going to still be waiting for us to do. And I don't want to cut off this conversation, but we're supposed to wrap up at 7:30, I think. Is that right, Doreen?
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing that we have on the agenda is that we wanted to have some recognition of a couple of folks that have given a lot to our Public Health Advisory Council. So I'm kind of looking to you, Dr. Melnick, and Roxanne to help decide how we want to spend the last 15 minutes, or are the majority of us able to continue our time? And so those are kind of the we're at a waypoint here.
We definitely want to make sure that we have the chance to talk about the recognition. I think that's important, and then also the bylaws subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Melnick, if you're okay with that, I think we were going to have a little bit of information about 1152. Maybe we can include that in notes. Would you be okay with that?
Yeah, we can put that in the notes if that works.
Okay, and I can talk about the subcommittee. And then we can maybe move on to the recognitions. So let's go forward with that. Unless there are any.
Okay.
So I think the next thing is the, I believe that the next thing is the executive committee and council member updates. And I have an update that it's been identified that our Public Health Advisory Council needs to have a subcommittee formed that can look at our bylaws in the face of the House Bill 1152, because we are going to have some changes to our role, although it's, from what I understand, the design of the Public Health Advisory Council, I think they're calling it something different going forward, was somewhat fashioned after the way we work. So that's a good thing. But what we do need is to ask our committee, our council, it's kind of a call to action. For folks who'd be interested in working on a subcommittee, please let Doreen know, or you can tell us right now, that we'll look at our bylaws and look at the House Bill 1152 and see what we need to do in order to be in compliance with that, so we can get ahead of this and not be laggards and have to be told, you know, how we have to change things. Let us be the ones to decide how we want to change things to comply with the new law. So please feel free to volunteer now or let Doreen know of your interest.
Marla, is there a timeline on when this needs to be done? In the next month, 6 months?
We wanted to start soon because the law is already in. It has been enacted, and so, or is that not right, Dr. Mullen?
So the changes take effect January 1st, 2022.
Okay.
So we want to start now because, you know, getting it ready for, and there's no reason why you couldn't do this, you know, get it all put into place earlier, but I believe the 1152 makes the changes occur January 1st of 2022.
Okay. So that's my understanding, that we know what the changes are going to be based on what's written in the law, and we know what our bylaws say. So we just need to do some reconciliation, make sure that we're ahead of this.
I can throw Michelle under the bus. I know Michelle likes bylaws, I believe, but she's muted.
I was just looking at it right now. I was just looking at it. It's only 18 pages. I was thinking it was like 70-something.
No, it's not. Okay.
And the changes are basically about what you do, as well as,
right.
I think there's one of the Board of Health members is an ex officio member, so there's slight changes, but it's not huge.
All right. Is this a committee or is this a Michelle? I'm being a volunteer.
It's a subcommittee.
Okay.
There are already at least a couple people that have expressed interest. So it's not.
Oh, okay. I'll work with people on it. I thought it was Michelle do it.
No, thank you for offering.
Okay.
Anyone else want to declare their interest now? It's not. Please feel free to think it over and let Doreen know if you have an interest.
So, Doreen, will somebody email me or will you let me know who I'm working with?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will assist in scheduling some time for you, too. So I can set up a doodle poll because there'll be some members of the leadership team, I'm assuming, like Roxanne or Dr. Melnick, who will participate as well. So, yes, I will help with that.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
And I've expressed an interest also. So, and I think we have at least one other member of the executive committee that is interested. So we'll get a group.
Okay.
Okay, then I think the next thing is to move forward with the next thing on the agenda, which is some recognitions. Have I left anything out? Doreen, can you think of anything? Okay, then I believe that you, Dr. Melnick, will be stepping up for this part of it.
Right, so let me start with Charbonneau Gord, who's been our educational representative. He's been on FAC, I believe, for 2 years, and he had to step off. But I really want to, he's been a great representative of the educational community, I mean, and really appreciated his work on the council, and I just wanted to recognize him for his service over the last couple of years on FAC. So I wanted to mention that. So thank you. I don't think he's on tonight, unfortunately, so... But did want to recognize him for that.
Thank you.
Okay. That's number one. Number two is we have a FAC member, one of a very few charter members. FAC began in 2003, and Joan Cayley, I mean, where do I even begin with Joan? Joan's been an incredibly dedicated member of FAC, beginning with its very beginning in 2003. So Joan's been on FAC for 18 years, and she's been a huge advocate for public health issues. Worked on, you might recall, the Growing Healthier report that included, you know, access to opportunities for physical activity, the social determinants of health, you know, housing, healthy neighborhoods, food access. That went into the county's comprehensive growth plan. Joan was a force of nature on that group. But it goes, her commitment in the community goes way beyond FAC. So those of you, some of you know, or some of you don't know, that Joan is a board-certified public community health nurse, community health nurse specialist and nursing faculty, both at University of Portland, as well as Washington State University, Vancouver. And she's been teaching, you know, the new generation of nursing students about community and population health. And, you know, when we were having in-person meetings, those of you who remember the in-person meetings, remember Joan would bring nursing students with her to FAC meetings, and a great exposure, a great role model for public health and community health nursing. Joan was also, you know, early on board around, and, you know, I think this is, for me, it's the holy grail of chronic disease prevention is eliminating early childhood trauma. And Joan has been at the forefront of that. She's active in the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences Action Alliance. She's provided training on adverse childhood experiences, and not only the effect that ACEs have on families and individuals, but also the effect that adverse childhood experiences have on the entire community. She's been a tireless advocate for public health, and Joan will be, you know, she's a force of nature on FAC, and I will definitely miss her. Will be leaving FAC, I believe, after 18 years. And I think, Doreen, do you have the, I don't know what the word I call a gift. You're going to show what we've gotten, Joan. Yeah, this is the, I wish you could pick it up and hold it, because it's significant there. But this is our appreciation for everything Joan has done in the community. She's been our City of Vancouver representative on FAC, and has represented City of Vancouver really well as well. So anyway, sorry for blabbing on so long, but I could talk for hours about Joan and her contribution. I've learned, she's been a mentor to me as well, and I've learned a tremendous amount from her.
Joan, is there anything that you would like to share with the group?
Well, 18 years goes by really fast. It's like, you know, as I think about my involvement and, you know, gee whiz, getting older, it's like I've gotten so involved with, I still am involved with ACES, and, but I've really gotten involved. I'm chair of the Vancouver Housing Authority and on the Council for the Homeless. And so, you know, my plate's only so big. And now that I have some grandchildren to spend some time with, I'm thinking, where can I push a little bit off the plate? And so in talking, especially with the mayor, you know, 18 years is a long time to serve. And so hopefully, you know, the city has the call out for representatives. And I really appreciate the opportunity to have served as the representative from Vancouver, and hope that there will be a lot of interest when the city picks the next person. And as I told Dr. Melnick, I will still continue periodically to be a guest and come and chip in my 2 cents worth. So, because this has been a part of my life for 18 years, you know, it's like now the baby's off to college. So, thank you all for your kind words and for the relationships that we've established over the years for many of us, especially Mark and Paul and I, who've been here from the very beginning. So. It's a long time, Paul and Mark, that we've been with this group. So, and I think it's really grown into being a very important group in our community. So, keep looking
forward. John, this is Paul. Thank you and congratulations. It's been a pleasure working with you.
Thanks, Paul. I'm not going away. I'm not sick or anything. Moving on.
I'm hoping you, not to put the pressure on, but your wise counsel is great. I'd love to see you as a guest. But
we'll be
I know
there.
You have a lot of other things on your plate.
So thank you. Thank you for that wonderful gift. I will look forward to touching it.
I will get it. I have it. I've been pretending it's mine. But I will definitely get it to you here shortly.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, I wish we were in person right now to be able to collectively give you a great big hug, Joan.
Oh, that's okay. I feel the hug, so I feel it. Thank you so much.
And it looks like it's going to be a little bit longer before we get to in-person meetings, unfortunately.
No.
You don't think we're going to go back to lockdown, do you think, Alan?
Well, you know, this came out on a, you know, we've had calls with DOH, but if you look at the numbers, and, you know, I've asked on the calls, you know, remember the phases?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I think having these large, you know, large events and large gatherings, not a good idea right now. And we actually brought it up on a state call about, you know, should we be, you know, re-implementing some restrictions? And the state isn't, I don't think the governor is going there.
A lot of it gets back to personal responsibility, you know, and I think that's where we all can role model that, you know, in the community. I just think that's so important that it takes every one of us in this community to manage this. So,
yeah, I'm just really, you know, I think along with everyone else in the community, we're all worried about those younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason for doing this is protect, you know, young people who are not eligible yet for vaccination. They're not immune.
What are the infant rates like around here, Alan? Just,
you know, I don't have that number, that breakdown. We could get the state breakdown. I'll see if I could get that for you. But, you know, there are several hundred children have died from COVID-19 across the country. And they're not, I mean, certainly the risk is a lot lower, but they're not immune to this. And adolescent hospitalizations are from adolescents have 2.5 to 3 times the hospitalization rate from this, and they have from flu. And flu is no picnic, but it's significantly worse disease in adolescents than influenza is.
I don't understand it. You know, I think if people haven't experienced that kid get the flu, or, you know, I've seen it. I will never miss another flu season for flu shots again.
I guess, you know, one comment I'd heard, you know, when around this issue about children, you know, several hundred children being dying of COVID-19, and a response I'd heard somewhere was, well, how many of them had underlying conditions? And I'm thinking, what difference does that make? I mean, if a child has asthma and dies, is that making any different? That's the kind of... This whole, you know, we talk about communications and all that, this whole situation, you know, where have we gotten to this point, you know?
Important decisions we're making.
I will just say, for a quick search on the Department of Health's website, they're not sub-segregating data by life course age associated with infants, so it's 0 to age 19. Which really doesn't do us any favors, and the threshold cutoffs really should be aligned with vaccination age, and then by cohort in terms of environment. So birth to 5 to 12, 12 to, you know. So that could be a recommendation we make. There may be a way that we could
put that in there
behind the scenes data, but that's just from a quick search, cursory search during this dialogue. But
yeah, I just feel like those numbers need to be out there. I mean, you know, I think new parents, new moms, new dads, if they had that information.
They very well may have those data points, but they haven't called for a report that differentiates, you know, by those more granular ages. Right. But it's possible that they have, hopefully, accumulated that information.
Right.
But I don't know who would have influence, but if whatever, I think that they should be reporting that. So, all along. But I think what I'm going to offer up a suggestion that we kind of reflect on the richness that this group provides in terms of an opportunity to support our local public health efforts. And every single person that's a member of this group is doing important work. And we have people like Joan and Paul and Mark who have been leading the charge for 18 years. That's a long time. And so it makes me feel inspired to want to keep up the energy and continue to ask the question, what can we do to make a difference in the health of our community and leave no one behind? So those are kind of thoughts that I have. And would anyone else have any, this is what we do at the end of the meeting, is what are some other thoughts you may have that you'd like to share before we sign off?
Hey, Marla, this is Stephanie. Can I share a thought real quick?
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thanks. Hey, so I work in mental health in Clark County, and we recently learned of the only residential facility in the community is closing, and we're finding that a lot of our, for me it's patients, but you know, it's just community members are having a harder and harder time accessing mental health services right now. We hear a lot of places are understaffed, it's longer times for appointments, and again, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and which is impactful on people's mental health, and we are losing access to services. So I just wanted to just make sure that you guys were aware that that's something that's going on.
Thank you. That's really important. Thanks for sharing that. Other,
you know, Stephanie, piggybacking on that, I am hopeful because I do see I work in a nonprofit that does we see a lot of those breaks in services, and I'm hopeful because I know that we just received a grant to work with Unite Us Washington so that we could be that bridge for resources, so we don't have, you know, so we can make sure that people are getting those access to resources, and we can, you know, we can see where they are. Have they been tended to? Have they, you know, has DHS contacted them? Are they in touch with food providers? So
I think that there's a lot of new things coming out and other organizations. I believe there's 17 organizations that have signed on with Unite Us Washington here in Clark County. I know it's hard, but know that there are people like trying to build those bridges.
That's a great message. Thanks, Michelle. Anyone else want to make a comment or have anything to say? Well, I think that we should probably, it's 7:37, I think that we should ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second?
I'll second.
Paul, second.
Thank you. Okay, the meeting will be adjourned, and thank you to each and every one of you for your time and attention and commitment.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Bye.